on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us this morning. Today, I'm at the Enoch Pratt Library on the second floor of the Central Library on Cathedral Street. It's a really terrific exhibition that includes artifacts from the collection of Jean Thompson. Jean is a former editor at the Baltimore Sun, now working in public relations, and she has for many years now been collecting artifacts that tell the story of the African-American experience. The show is called Keeping It Real, One Collector's Quest for Artifacts of African-American Culture and History, and Jean Thompson is here to talk us and walk us through the exhibition. Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you.
So we're standing in front of a case that has a number of pieces of sheet music that are displayed, and I guess music is where you started in terms of your collecting life.
Yes, I have a very strong interest in music, although I truly don't play much, but I became fascinated with the lives of the African-American composers. So I developed my own list. This before the days of eBay and the internet, and I began searching for the actual music as it was sold in that artist's time. And I now have here in the exhibit music from 1820 through 1950, really. And it covers the periods of the blues, the spirituals, the popular music, marches, dance music, political music. It's a fascinating story because the covers and the music and the lyrics tell American history. And you can follow whether the writers were influenced by the news. Here's a piece called Dig Away Dempsey, Dig Away by African-American composer Gussie L. Davis. That's about the gold rush.
And there are some fascinating covers here. One of the things that was a real shock to me before I came to this exhibition, I had no idea that there were black performers who performed in blackface. And there are covers that show pictures of the performers in regular dress, and then on the same cover, it shows them in blackface. Here's one, words by Edward Ferber and music by Bert A. Williams, tunes called He's Up Against the Real Thing Now, and there's a picture of Mr. Williams and Mr. Walker in blackface. It's published by the Joseph Stern Company, and it's a big music publisher. That's fascinating. That why did black performers have to be in blackface?
Well, if you go back to the beginning of minstrelsy, which was really pre-vaudeville, that was a time when performers who at that time were primarily white were mocking the lives of African Americans who were living in slavery and who were, they would often wear, it became quite a formal thing to dress up and to wear the blackface and to sing these songs. Some of them were sort of pitiful and sad, and some of them were very comical. And this style of performing became embedded in American culture. Eventually, the producers hired what they called the authentic black performers to fill some of those roles. And they would search the country for talent. But when those performers were performing for white audiences, they were required to wear the blackface. And blackface, I want you to know, was as controversial. It was very controversial then, as it is now. Even Frederick Douglass had written that the black performers who were wearing the blackface should not be doing it, and the producers should not be making them do it. But you will see a big change in the 1890s, going into the turn of the century then, when African Americans began to own the rights to their own music and build their own publishing houses. There's a major shift. Suddenly, instead of the blackface man on the cover, you will see the man in the beautiful tuxedo or in his dinner suit. And then the blackface begins to go away because they make a stand.
Jean Thompson, her collection is on display here on the second floor of the Central Library, the Enoch Pratt. It's called One Collector's Quest for Artifacts of African American Culture and History on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. We're standing in front of a collection of dolls. They're all shapes and sizes. There's small ones, there's big ones. You tell a story here at the exhibition about a favorite doll that you had and the reaction that some of your friends had when you were a little kid to this doll.
Well, I'll divulge my age. I'm 55. And when I was a kid, African-American dolls were not plentiful. They're very difficult to find. If you could find one, they might be very expensive. So I didn't have any, except for those that my mother sewed for me or made for me. But I had cousins who were a little better off than I was, and I was visiting them with my dolls, and my favorite doll was Skipper. Skipper is the doll, is the little sister doll to Barbie. I wasn't allowed to have Barbie, much too provocative. But Skipper and I went to a party at my cousin's house, and my cousins, who are African American as well, they had black dolls, which of course I had not seen before. And they asked me a very difficult question. They said, and you know, I'm a little kid, and they say, well, do you hate yourself? Is that why you only play with white dolls? And I was shocked. I was appalled. I was in tears. I did not understand how hate had anything to do with it. And my aunt and my mother had to sit us all down together and explain to us the research that had been done by Dr. Kenneth Clark and his wife years ago. I believe it was done in the 1940s or 50s. And that research we've all heard about, where they did an experiment, black children and white children, black dolls and white dolls, which dolls will you play with? And the black children were choosing the white dolls and saying that the black dolls were not good. They just were not good. And this proved to many people that black children were taking in all of the hatred that was being bombarding them in the media, in advertising, in the segregated lives they were forced to live, and they were starting to hate themselves. And so once my parents and my aunt explained to us so that we had some context for it, that's how I learned about the Black is Beautiful movement.
There are so many artifacts. There are 10 cases in all filled with photographs and dolls and figurines and music. And some of it is quite personal. We're standing now in front of a case that has pictures of your family, including your current family, your husband Dion and your son Tevin. And there's a picture here of your maternal grandparents, your grandfather and grandmother, and your mother as a little girl. And you found in the course of collecting these things and in conversations with your maternal grandfather, he had quite a story.
Well, yes, I was helping him clean out his house before he moved into a nursing home, and I found a valise that had inside some union cards and programs from union conventions in the film industry. There were movie stars and photos of famous directors in this catalog. And I asked him, how did you end up in that place, in that time period? And the story that unfolded that I'd never heard before in my life was that he was half white and half black. His father basically abandoned them after he was born. As he grew up, he was raised African American in Greensboro, North Carolina, and he moved ultimately to Washington, D.C. as a young adult, where it was much easier to get a job if you were white. And so he began to do what is called passing. He began to live as though he were a white man. Now, he married my grandmother, who's very much darker than he is, and the law at the time prohibited blacks and whites from marrying. So in order to keep this charade going, they had to hide their marriage as well as hide their child when my mother was born. He could not be seen in the city or in some of the meetings he attended or even going out to a restaurant if he was in the company of my grandmother and my mother. So my mother was sent basically back to North Carolina. She was raised in North Carolina by my grandfather's aunt. And the family lived separately. Eventually, he tells me, they found a place to live that was on the border of a white neighborhood and a black neighborhood. And while they were living there, the people around them knew that he was black. They knew that he was mixed race. But they kept the secret for him until it began to destroy them and destroy their relationship. As you can imagine, this is a very difficult way to live. And what he told me is he basically woke up one morning and said, "That's enough. I want my family. I want my life back." He quit his job, which was a very good job. He went back. He got my mother from North Carolina. He reunited his family, and he started over again in Washington. And the first job he was able to get was as a janitor. He was no longer going to be wearing a suit and tie and going to national conventions. But he told me that he would rather be proud and have dignity and be with his family and be who he was. It was a hard life then. And I'm really, in many ways, it touches me deeply that he was willing to do that. But there's a ripple effect throughout the Black community wherever this happened, and it happened fairly often.
That's an amazing story, and there are so many amazing stories embedded in this exhibition. You are a storyteller. You were in the newspaper business as a journalist for many years. When folks come and they see these artifacts, they see these things, what stories do you think they'll take away? Because as you say, so many of the things that happened to you and your family are indicative of the things that were happening throughout the Black community for generations.
Well, I think the most important thing that I want people to take away is that history is not just made by the mighty, that we write our history every day as we live. And we all know, you hear it all the time, that if you don't know your history, then you're doomed, in effect, to repeat the worst parts of it. So many people in the African American community don't know about the great people, the people on whose shoulders we stand. A lot of those stories are not in the textbooks. They are literally wiped out of the textbooks. And so part of my mission in collecting has always been to find those stories, to find those people, and to find the trail that they left for us. The trail's here.
Well, Jean Thompson, thank you so much for sharing this exhibition with our city and for your time this morning. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Jean Thompson, the exhibition is called Keeping It Real, One Collector's Quest for Artifacts of African American Culture and History. It's here at the Enoch Pratt Central Library on the second floor. It's here until March 30th. We'll have a complete link to complete information on our website. Come to wypr.org/Marilyn Morning. I'm 88.1 reporting from the Pratt Library in downtown Baltimore. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Have a great day.